Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. This is hour number two of the show. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. I think it's true that most people believe some level of governmental secrecy is necessary. But the question we'll take up this morning in this hour is this. When does keeping information from the American people abuse the public trust? We'll be talking in this hour about the history of executive branch efforts to consolidate its power through the control of information. And we have with us two guests. They are the authors of a recently published book that's titled Presidential Secrecy and the Law. It is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And our guests are Robert Polito. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Seton Hall University. That's in South Orange, New Jersey. And also William Weaver. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Texas, El Paso. He is also Director of Academic Programs at UT El Paso's Institute for Policy and Economic Development. They are joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have them as guests. As we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. All we ask is the people are brief so that we can move along, get in as many callers as possible, but questions are welcome. If you're listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Polito, hello.
Yes, good morning.
And Professor Weaver.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And thank you to both of you for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it. Being on the show, I'm sure it doesn't rise to the level of The Daily Show, but, you know, we'll see what we can do. Just to begin, I'm certain that it is the case that all presidential administrations have secrets. They're interested in keeping secrets, both for reasons of national security and also to prevent embarrassment. So I'm sure all presidents have done it. Having said that, do you think that it is the case that this administration, the Bush administration, is more inclined to keep secrets than previous administrations? And you know, I'm sure both of you might want to have an answer. Why don't we just start with Professor Polito and then Professor Weaver, you can comment as well.
Sure. I guess what struck us, we started working on this project by looking at one particular aspect of presidential secrecy, which is the state secrets privilege. It's a legal doctrine that the executive branch can use to keep information from coming out in litigation. And I guess my experience was, I don't know if it was the same for Bill, but as we researched this one power, we saw that interconnected with it were all these other powers. And the book kind of goes through them one by one. And with each of the secrecy-related powers that we discuss, it seemed like they were being used in an accelerated way by this administration, although, as you say, every president has tried to protect information of one kind or another.
Hmm. All right. Professor Weaver?
Sure, I would agree with that. We did start off with the state secrets privilege and expanded when we saw that there was a lot of interconnected use, especially in this administration. And really the acceleration for presidential secrecy began in the 1970s and with the Carter administration after the Nixon debacle. And when Congress started trying to exercise their greater oversight over the national security venues that were controlled by the president. And the president has available to him or her a whole host of privileges that the normal human being living on Earth has never heard of. The state secrets privilege, the Glomar response, the Totten Doctrine, the Mosaic Theory, things that are, you know, that were used in disparate ways over the last several decades and used in ad hoc manner in particular cases. But what we've seen in this particular administration, the Bush administration, is that they've all come together in a very contrived, controlled, interconnected strategy of secrecy, and that the central axis of this administration, I think it's not stretching the truth to say it, is secrecy. that the defining feature of the Bush administration is the introduction of this kind of multi-picketed use of secrecy to prevent Congress and the public from knowing anything about what they're doing.
Hmm. This administration certainly has been criticized for its expansive view of presidential power. And that is something that I think predates 9/11, although you can't ignore what has happened since. Do you think that is the case that this tendency to this inclination to secrecy and to use these various powers that the president has is, do you see that being connected with the Bush administration's view of presidential power? And again, I don't know. I'll go to Professor Weaver again. We'll go back the other way.
Yeah, I guess my answer would be, of course, for us. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just read the Wall Street Journal today, for example, you see that Mike McConnell, who's the director of National Intelligence, and Michael Chertoff, who's the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, have agreed several months ago to allow the most sophisticated and advanced satellite techniques for analysis, imagery, development, to be used against U.S. citizens. Now, that's a decision that has to be made at the highest levels. It has to be made, you know, the president has to sign off on this. And it's just, you know, kind of an example of the day, if you will, of how this president pushes to the extreme edge, and I believe past that edge, the constitutional power of the presidency as it was envisioned, right, originally.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, I'll direct a question to Professor Polito. One, as I said, you can't ignore the importance here of the attacks of 9/11 and what has been called the war on terror here, I'm assuming that that would be a major justification for the administration to do what it has done. Do you think, in fact, that we would be having this conversation quite in this way if it had not been for 9/11?
I don't think so. I mean, we say in the book that that those events just generated a very powerful, on the one hand, a very powerful desire on the part of the public to have an aggressive response to terrorism, but on the other hand, it really did change the administration and cause them to focus a lot on fighting terror in aggressive ways that relied on secrecy. But there are a couple of examples that come to mind right away that are in some way either previous to or independent of the September 11th attacks. And one is that in the summer of 2001, there was a Supreme Court decision having to do with the rights of deportation subjects, people who are about to be deported. And that decision went against the administration. And so before 9/11, the Attorney General, then John Ashcroft, was in the process of pushing for changes that would help to minimize the effect of the Supreme Court ruling. And those changes relied on secrecy. They relied on curtailment of individual rights. That was one example. And the other one, which is very familiar to the public, is the Energy Policy Development Group that was headed by the Vice President, and that the litigation worked its way through and concluded after September 11th, but certainly the formation of the group started before, and everybody, I think, remembers that the administration was very reluctant to let anyone know even the identities of the participants in the Energy Advisory Group, and Congressman Waxman showed how the administration was trying to use loopholes in federal law to keep any kind of oversight from happening of the industry executives who were in the advisement process there. So those would be two examples of things that were happening outside of the terrorism and response to terrorism area.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, and I think at the same time that people have been critical of the administration for, as I say, this expansive view of presidential policy, there has also been criticism for Congress, and people feel that perhaps the Congress has failed in its role to be the intended check on the power of the presidency, and they would trace that in large part initially at the beginning of the Bush administration of the fact that the the president was a Republican and the Congress was controlled by Republicans, and they were not wanting to get into the president's way. Some people perhaps think that that might change now that we have a democratically controlled Congress, although I think you I'll turn back to Professor Weaver. I think in the book you all seem to question whether, in fact, the things will change very much with Democrats in control. And, of course, I suppose we don't have really all that much longer in this administration in any case. What do you think? What can you say about the Congress and how perhaps it has enabled the administration to do this simply by standing back and doing nothing?
Well, I don't think we're going to see any changes, to be perfectly honest. I think that there will be an utter failure of accountability under the Democratic regime, just as there was under the Republican regime in Congress. My member of Congress that represents me, Sylvester Reyes, is a chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, which is the House version of the Oversight Committee for Intelligence and National Security Activity. To say that he's friendly to the administration is an understatement. And if you go on to the other side, he's a Democrat, of course, and then you go to the Senate Select Committee for Intelligence, you find the same thing. There's not going to be any change. I work with an organization called the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and we went around to every Democratic member of Congress before the Democrats retook Congress and got their promises about legislation and oversight concerning national security matters and whistleblowers and protection, and now they don't return our phone calls. So, you know, it's not going to change. I hate to have such a, such a cynical view of it, but this is not a Republican-Democratic issue. This is a, it's far deeper than that.
Well, do you think you explain that simply by saying that the Democrats expect that one day there will be a Democrat in the White House and they would like to see their man or woman, as the case may be, have as much unrestricted power as possible? Or is there something, as you say, something even deeper about in the disinclination of Congress to take this head on?
One of the things that Rob and I point out in the book is that whenever Congress has tried to restrict presidential power in the area of national security, not only have they failed, they've ended up boosting presidential power. If you look at a number of statutes like the War Powers Act, which is, Unleashing War Act, really, which, it was meant to constrain the president, really has empowered the president to engage in war activity. If you look at the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was designed to inhibit the abuse of illegal wiretaps, right, ordered by the president, you find that now it's become institutionalized. You have this huge industry now, and there's no possible way that you can penetrate and know what's going on with FISA or with those kinds of wiretaps. And the president and his or her staff are insulated completely now by a legal process. So one of the things we say in the book is that every time Congress tries to step up and control presidential power in the national security area, they fail. And we say rather counterintuitively what they should do is just lay off and not try to control it via statute, but try to control it via public opinion and embarrassment and through the investigatory process. And they're failing, unfortunately, on all these grounds.
Well, I think, Professor Polito, also one of the things that I think that you both argue in the book is that perhaps the more important branch of government here that can more effectively control the power of the president, the power of the executive, is not the Congress, it's the courts.
I think we agree with that, and unfortunately it frequently has not been the case that the state secrets privilege is something that the Supreme Court essentially created out of whole cloth in the 1950s. There were other cases dealing with government secrecy, but there was no state secrets privilege in the contours that the court drew before the U.S. v. Reynolds case in the 1950s. And we found out later that was essentially built on a foundation of sand because the secrets that were the alleged secrets in that case turned out to be nothing. In late in the 1990s, the information that the government went to court to protect surfaced and became available to the public, and we could see that there was absolutely nothing that related to national security involved. So unfortunately, well, first of all, we agree that the courts need to step in and constrain and control these different uses of secrecy, and many times it has to do with civil liberties and constitutionally protected rights. But unfortunately, sometimes courts have done exactly the opposite, and we see them saying things like, it's not our area of expertise here. It's not something that we can really weigh out the way the executive can. And to us, that's very disturbing because, on the other hand, we've known for more than 200 years now, as the Marbury case says, that it's the duty of the courts to say what the law is. And if they're not going to say it, then who's going to?
Let me introduce again the guests for this part of Focus 580. The last person you heard, Robert Polito. He's assistant professor of political science at Seton Hall University. And also with us is William Weaver. He is associate professor of political science at University of Texas, El Paso. They are together authors of a recently published book. The title is Presidential Secrecy and the Law. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. We are open to questions from people who are listening, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps I might ask you, here I'll go back to Professor Weaver, as you said, one of you said that the way this project started was with looking at the state secrets privilege. And this is something that... I certainly didn't know anything about. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about this. I guess it's my understanding that what this is, if there's a case in court and the administration, the president, whoever the president is, there's something that might be introduced as evidence in this case, and the president does not want it to become public, all the president needs to do is say, there's a possibility that national security would be endangered if this becomes public knowledge. And so I want you to keep the secret. And that's all it takes. It just essentially the word of the president, the national security is at stake, and some piece of information can be closed to the public. Is that essentially it?
Yeah, I guess the process works like this, is that in discovery, when litigants want information, the head of a department normally asserts the privilege, but it's usually with the assent, if not always with the assent, of the President of the United States or his or her staff. And then there are two affidavits that are prepared. One is a classified affidavit that goes to the judge in camera, which means that only the judge sees it. And the other is a public affidavit, which goes to the lawyers, right, for the plaintiffs, generally the plaintiffs. And the classified affidavit creates, usually tells a horror story of what will happen if this information is made public. You know, the republic will fall, you know, all these sorts of things. And judges are cowed into granting pretty much the assertion of the state secrets privilege on every occasion. In fact, there's never been a single case where any classified document or claimed document that would be damaging to the national security has been ordered released when the state secrets privilege has been asserted. Now, there is, I said earlier that I work with this organization, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. The head of that organization is a woman named Sibel Edmonds, and she worked for the FBI, and she has had the state secrets privilege asserted against her several times in several cases that she has been involved with. And in one case, the survivors of the victims of 9/11, family survivors, sued Egypt and a number of other governments and organizations, and they wanted to conduct a deposition with Sibel because she had information that would be helpful to them. They asserted the state secrets privilege and prevented her from saying when she was born, where she was born, what languages she speaks, and where she went to school. So, and the court approved that. And so something that you could talk about over a Starbucks coffee was found to be so damaging if made public to the national interest that a lawyer would be prevented from asking those questions in a deposition. Mm-hmm. So it's an extraordinarily powerful privilege that never loses. But we're on our way to a super privilege. I don't want to carry on too long here, but we're on our way actually to a privilege that will outstrip the state secrets privilege in power. And that's what's kind of an argument that's going on today in the case of Hepting in California and Al-Haramain are two cases that are being heard by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal today. And we'll probably, when they get to the U.S. Supreme Court, will define the contours of the state secrets privilege. And I think we're going to end up actually with something, a privilege that is more powerful than the state secrets privilege is right now.
Hmm. Well, just I have a caller here, and let me come back to Professor Polito. You can add anything that you like. It sounds as if really the problem, the significant reality here is we're dealing with is under this privilege and perhaps some other provisions there, it seems as if it is very easy for an administration or someone representing the administration simply to say that some particular piece of information should be kept secret, should be closed, and because we say so, and that there is very little in the way of mechanisms to check that. That is, that there is no one, that there are very few other parties that get the opportunity to look at that same information and make some judgment about whether or not there is some compelling public interest for it to be made public, or that even if there is, security interest should trump that. It just seems that it's an almost unreserved power of the administration to say this should be secret and that's that and that's the end of the discussion. Is that a fair enough description of where we are, or is that an overstatement?
No, I think it's a very fair description of where we are. The case that Bill mentioned that's being heard in the Ninth Circuit today, in that case, the trial judge, I mean, the case, it's not like the individual plaintiffs sued the government and won, and now it's being appealed. The trial judge in that case simply said, at this time, we don't see enough of a reason to dismiss the case outright without proceeding any further. And even though even that very limited refusal to close down litigation has been met with a very strong response by the government, and they've taken it up on appeal while the trial is pending, and so here they don't even want to get to looking at individual pieces of information and saying should this be released or should this not be released. They want the whole case to go away before we even have a chance to do any of that balancing. One of the things that disturbs me a lot is many times the government lawyers in these cases talk about, well, we don't want to get into separation of powers questions. In other words, if we proceed here in this litigation, if we talk about this further, then it's really impinging on the president's power. But that seems sort of perverse to me, because how do we know what the powers are that are separated? And, you know, don't we have to engage in some kind of inquiry into how far can the courts go, how far do individual rights extend, before we can even resolve difficult conflicts between governments and individuals? And the super privilege that Bill is talking about, I think that's starting to emerge, works to say, you know, we don't even get into those kinds of discussions. Justice Thomas has said in several reported opinions that the courts are just not, even his own court, is not fit, is not competent to look into these kind of questions, to engage in this kind of balancing, just defer to the executive. And to me, that's very frightening.
Let's talk with someone here. We have want to join the conversation. The caller's in Effingham, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about obviously these with the 9/11 and the security of the country, the things are probably viewed a little bit differently, as we always see in times of emergencies. World War One, we had problems in the Civil War, lots of rights are taken away. What I'm concerned about is how do we compare ourselves with England and Israel as two examples of doing similar things that they are doing. I'd like to hear if you have any insight on those two countries and how they handle dealing with citizens and spying and so on. Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Weaver, maybe you can try and take a shot at that, and then Professor Polito as well. And I suppose you needn't limit yourself to those countries as well, but any particular examples that you think are good looking at how other countries deal with similar issues?
Well, I think that we are a country that is sliding down a slope of, that's inevitable, a slope of the use of technology to surveil people broadly. I mean, and under the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, before you go after somebody, you have to have individualized suspicion. Even under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, before you wire someone up, you have to have individualized suspicion. But now we're working with, and presidents and executive branch divisions are creating massive databases of information that they collect on people that is interconnected, your credit card activity, what you buy at the supermarket, your prescription activity, where you're stopped for a ticket. And we're moving inevitably towards an electronic integration of information that will allow the government to evaluate each person through threat analysis software and assign a threat value to them or something of that nature. And Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. Lincoln committed all sorts of atrocities on the Constitution. But then after the war was over, we put him back. The problem back is here is that the war will never end that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. This war is one that is in perpetuity, and therefore there is in perpetuity, because terrorism is not going to go away, a justification for greater and greater use of technology to invade the private sphere, and I believe that it's simply inevitable that that will occur to, well, you know, the future is not particularly happy on that score.
Hmm. And I'll turn to Professor Polita, and in fact, you know, maybe saying something about other countries is outside of your, since the two of you are pretty much concentrating here on the United States, I don't know if that's something that you can discuss, that is how other countries approach the same subject.
Well, I guess it's true that I study American politics, and I'm reluctant sort of to go outside of my area of expertise. But, I mean, there are a couple of connections that could be made here. And with regard to Britain, Bill has done research on looking at the way concepts of English law relating to the power of the executive have been sort of transported into American law as if the two systems are identical. And, of course, there are some very significant differences, particularly since crown privilege is, some people see as a precursor to state secrets privilege, had to do with the British crown. And obviously we don't have a king in this country. And so it immediately you're sort of comparing two very different things and trying to trace development of a doctrine like state secrets privilege from a country with a monarch, although also a country with obviously a democratically elected legislature, into the United States. And so that's immediately problematic, and shows a difference how there might be arguments that would be available in the British context to talk about executive power that wouldn't be absent here. Number one, I guess the other sort of comparative comment I would make is talking about the state of Israel. Certainly, the human rights record there is not great. But one link that I see is emphasis on state survival. The actions that the Israeli government takes are often predicated on, well, we need to protect the survival of the nation. And here, that is sort of the core justification for a lot of the secrecy initiatives that we talk about in the book, and particularly state secrets privilege. You know, there's a famous statement by Justice Jackson, the Constitution is not a suicide pact, so we don't follow the Constitution and watch the nation be destroyed for the sake of its Constitution. But there's a real problem with invoking that kind of last resort argument, because most of the time we're far, far short of that. The instances that Bill was talking about where Sybelle Edmonds was barred from giving this commonly available information, what languages she spoke, where she was born. Another example would be the state secrets privilege was asserted in the Area 51 case, where the workers at that secret government facility were poisoned by substances they were working with, and they tried to get information about what they were exposed to so their doctors could treat them. And the Clinton administration said even to assert the existence of, or even to admit the existence of a place called Area 51 would endanger national security. And so it's, to say the least, extremely irresponsible for a president to use that last resort argument in cases that fall way short of actual threats to the existence of the nation. It's dangerous. It's dangerous to our tradition of rule of law, to
right. Well, why don't we, again, we'll take another call here. And this is someone listening in Charleston, line one. Hello.
Yes, the drift of this conversation, and it has occurred to me, as just a member of just one of 300 million people in this country, and what do we really know? All we know is what, in my opinion, is what the establishment wants us to know. 9/11, all I've ever saw of Al-Qaeda has been those fellows swinging around on playground equipment and bin Laden firing a gun into nowhere over and over again. The hype that has surrounded the plane crashes into the Twin Towers, as if this was an invasion by another country, which it was not. If Al-Qaeda actually existed in the magnitude that it is made out to be, they have no Air Force, they have no Navy, they have no standing army, they are ill-armed for international combat, and if terrorism, as we know it, have been told what it is, seems to be the only really international weapon that we've been told about. And all this is piling up as if somehow credence is to be made and given to George Bush, who is an astute, absolute liar, and all the cronies and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, people like that who have now saturated the American public with this fear, and how that we must abolish all the laws, the Constitution, that we are under attack. I mean, jeepers, they have two buildings went down, and that's that. And now we're over here massacring Arabs again in Iraq. Can you explain some of that?
Well, I don't know which way you would like to go first. Professor Polito, you want to reflect on what the caller said?
Well, it hit on a lot of parts of our recent history that are very disturbing to me. I guess one comment that I would make about it is that we were at this juncture after 9/11 where we had a tremendous amount of sympathy from the world. And we had, it seemed to me, at least my experience living in the New York area at that time, a tremendous amount of solidarity as a nation. And we could have gone one of two ways. We could have gone a route of seeking cooperation, seeking to build on the goodwill and sympathy that existed in the world, or we could go in another direction, which is exactly what we did, direction of greater secrecy, direction of rejecting anything but military response. And it's one of the many tragedies that have grown out of that initial tragedy on September 11th. It seems to me we had a choice of how to respond. Something had to be done, but there was a whole different response or set of responses that could have led us in a different direction. And I think we have, as a direct result of the path that the president took, we've seen a lot of death, a lot of destruction, in the name of making the world safer. Or making the United States safer. And I'm not sure that we got the promised result for all the suffering and death.
Hmm. Professor Weaver, would you want to add anything on to that?
Yeah, I guess I would agree with everything that Rob said. And I have a little bit different take, as I spent almost 10 years in the Army working as an asset for the National Security Agency at two field stations in Europe and during the Cold War. So intercepting Soviet communications and things of that nature. And so I don't want to minimize the threats. I wouldn't go so far as the caller's, characterization of Al-Qaeda as something that is basically toothless. But certainly, the President of the United States and his advisors astutely glommed on to the tragedy of 9/11 to increase presidential power to a point now that I'm not sure that the clock can be turned back on much of this stuff. So the thing that bothers me the most, I guess, is that Americans 6 years later are still so gullible as to buy into this fear and to not really begin to question in a serious way the mode of operation of the executive branch, which has become, in one word, secrecy. And, you know, without transparency, without knowing what our government is doing, of course, they will do whatever they want if they know that they will never have to be exposed. And I guess my real disappointment is with the American people on that score, but of course I agree with everything that Rob said.
All right. I want to thank the caller. Just again to introduce for anyone who might have tuned in, our two guests for this hour, William Weaver. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's also Director of Academic Programs at the Institute for Policy and Economic Development there at UT El Paso. And Robert Polito, he is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Seton Hall University. That's in South Orange, New Jersey. And the two of them are the co-authors of a recently published book exploring the subject we're talking about here this morning. The title of the book is Presidential Secrecy and the Law, and it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to ask a question to get this straight in my mind, the kind of things that you're talking about in this book, that is the president's authority to classify information and so forth, None of these powers are, and correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly they're not new in the sense that it was something that had come along after 9/11. Is it not the case that most of these had been on the books, had been a matter of law for some time, at least going, you know, the FISA was created in the late 70s, I think. So at least that's been around at least that long. Is any of this really new?
Well, the book is organized into chapters that deal with particular secrecy-related powers, and of all of them that we discussed, the only one that's really new in the sense of being post 9/11 is this set of anti-terror initiatives. And of course, there were obviously anti-terror laws prior to 9/11, and there were laws and programs that were expanded or beefed up after 9/11. But that's the only one that really talks in terms of a specific response to 9/11. I think the other chapters tell a story about each of the powers: the power to conduct national security surveillance, the power to protect state secrets, the power to claim executive privilege. Executive privilege, people know from the Nixon administration and the litigation that came out of Watergate. So I would say that of the things that we discuss in the book, the only one that is new in the sense of post or coming out of 9/11 is the anti-terror initiatives, and even those are based in part on existing laws, but certainly that chapter talks about a new regime in terms of how to address terror threats.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that none of these things have built into them any sort of mechanism that says something like periodically it might be a good idea for the Congress to review how they work or how they're used?
No. I mean, I guess I would add to what Rob said is that none of the powers are new, but the way they have been arranged and the way they become the central attention of this administration is new.
Hmm.
This level of secrecy, you know, this expansion of these powers is, and this commitment to secrecy is new. No, there really isn't anything built in. I mean, there is in, for example, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, there is judicial review. And then you have the select committees in House and Senate, which are to engage in accountability activity for national security, actions by the executive branch. But, you know, you have to, if we take a little bit longer view, when did this stuff really start, these secrecy powers? They started post World War II, generally, these strong secrecy powers that became enshrined in law and in some cases statute. And then that's because we had the development of nuclear weapons, and so you therefore had to have somebody that can make decisions very quickly, and you had advanced technology that you did not want to get into the hands of third parties. And one thing that people probably don't realize is that virtually all information that is classified solely at the fiat of the President of the United States under an executive order. There is no legislative authority for classification of what's called national security information at all. That is all done solely by the president's whim. Congress has passed a couple of statutes that deal, that classify information, most notably in the area of nuclear technology, which is called restricted data. But everything else that's classified is classified by executive order. So the president, therefore, since the late 50s, at least, has claimed that he or she has complete and utter unimpeded control over national security. Now, up until this point, national security generally has been translated as the ability to do things outside the United States. But since 9/11, national security has become, the line has become fuzzed up. And that these powers that we used with impunity against countries, foreign countries, and against external entities are now being used against U.S. citizens, and the justification, again, is this plenary power of the President of the United States to control national security matters. So Congress has been absent from this. Almost everything that's done in the area of national security is done without oversight or authorization by Congress, in the sense of classification of information.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have three callers here. We'll try to get them all in. They can help us by trying to be brief. And let's go to Savoy for the next line one. Hello.
You said that every time Congress tries to control executive power in time of war, ends up expanding it. Why is that? Especially now we have a Congress which is in control of the party, not the president's. Don't we have any congressmen that read the Constitution and believe it?
No.
Well, that's simple.
That's a pretty direct answer, yeah.
I'm sorry, Rob. Yeah, I think Rob.
Yeah, Professor Polito, you can expand on that answer a little bit.
Well, it's unfortunately pretty accurate, I think. But, I mean, there are a couple of things going on. One is political scientist James Sundquist has pointed out that the president is in kind of a different institutional role from Congress members, and a lot of what individual members of Congress worry about is getting the people in their district or in their state to reelect them. So they think about what's good for the state, they think about trying to keep controversy to a minimum, bring money to the state, and there's more risk and less reward if you sort of step out front and try to defend the Constitution, because a lot of voters aren't going to be interested in that the same way that they're interested in sort of the immediate short-term benefits of the constituency. I find that sad, but I think it's an accurate observation that Sundquist makes. And then the other thing is that it's, you know, sometimes hard to get Congress to act as a body. I mean, there are plenty of people who study Congress can tell you there are plenty of instances of individual Congress members acting heroically and standing up against laws or other actions by the president that they think are wrong. But as a group, it's difficult with all of the sort of alliances and allegiances pulling in different directions to get Congress to act in sort of a unitary way on something like defending our individual rights. I mean, it's funny because teaching these kind of this kind of subject matter in college classes, I find some students who are concerned, but I find a lot of students who are less interested, find it abstract, find questions of rights being threatened abstract and tangential to the real central focus of their lives, whether it's financial security or professional advancement. So I think there's kind of sometimes it's difficult to match up the desire of a legislator to protect the system, protect our political traditions, and also gain currency with voters.
All right. I want to thank the call. Let's go to line two. This is Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering what you make of some of the allegations that some of the data mining and the wiretapping was actually installed prior to 9/11, that things Cheney was supposedly de-anonymizing NSA documents and getting, you know, individuals, Americans' names at a very early stage. And it seems to me that, you know, this I don't know, you mentioned plenary powers. I always hear it as called the unitary executive powers. These people have the theory that maybe goes back to Rehnquist's brief for Nixon when he was wiretapping, that common law power of the monarchy is what apparently he argued, and that you know that it can be traced back to that kind of absolutism that these people think is there. There's so little time, and I have other subjects, but I'll just sign off. Thanks.
All right. Well, Professor Weaver, you want to take that one?
Yeah, on the unitary executive, which really is a theory that says basically that, sure, all of these branches, the three branches, are created by the Constitution, but the president occupies a position of authority above them. It's a sort of modified tyranny approach to the Constitution, and it's one which is hotly debated because there's no evidence whatsoever that there was, anything that was meant to emplace a monarch-like figure in power. So other than, scattered evidence here and there, but we're talking about as a whole, right, in the Constitution. So, I don't know. Rob, you want to weigh in on this? This is your area. You've studied this more than I have.
Well, I guess the unitary executive is a theory that both political figures and academics are sort of bandying about now. And I guess bottom line to me is that we live in a system where the people control, or at least theoretically we do. And one of the claims that proponents of the unitary executive make is that the president can defend his constitutional power by ignoring what the other branches say. So in other words, if a court orders a president to release documents, right, based on their interpretation and application of law and issue a court order saying release the documents, then the executive is justified in saying this impinges. In fact, I'm almost quoting verbatim from something Justice Scalia said at an oral argument a couple of years ago. No, this infringes too much on my power, my constitutional power as chief executive, and I'm not going to do it. And that's sort of the bottom line constitutional conflict, and the unitary executive people come down and saying, yeah, the president can do that, and I guess I don't. It really bothers me. I mean, I think of times, Nixon made some claims like that at times. If I do it, it's not illegal because I'm the president. But he also, in different areas, said, I remember when reading the his responses to the busing decision, Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg, and he said, well, I don't agree with the court, but I'm bound to follow the court. And, of course, that's a political calculation, how you respond to a Supreme Court decision. But sometimes when I hear this administration, I wonder if we've gotten even further towards the unitary executive in practice, which is I'll decide when to follow the law and when not to follow the law. The president gave a press conference about a month ago, and he was talking about the war and said Congress doesn't conduct this war. I do. And then he said, I'm certainly interested in their opinion. And that remark just struck me, almost as if it was sort of, people he was looking to for advice or something, rather than the representatives of the people in a democratic government.
Yeah.
But
well,
I don't want to go on too long.
Well, it certainly seems, it seems to be the case that there has been a striking expansion of presidential power now going back to World War II. That really, it kicked it up. Then there was the Cold War, and now there is the War on Terror. And that idea that there should be particularly expansive presidential power in time of war seems to be one that is backed up, at least as you say, by some members of the Supreme Court. Now, in my mind, that goes up against what I understand to be the intention of the framers when they put this government system that we have together, that in fact, contrary to maybe what you might remember from high school civics, I think it is the case that the framers intended that Congress should actually be the most powerful of the three branches. I mean, how do we, if that is the case, is it possible to wrench things back a little bit from where they are now, or do you think that that's difficult, if not impossible?
I guess to the extent that that we buy into this idea of a permanent warfare state, then we're never going to make any progress. In fact, we're going to go down the wrong road. We have to pull back from the idea of a permanent warfare state. We have given the president carte blanche to do what he's done without any kind of time limits on it. And when I say we, I mean the United States people. We've been manipulated, as a couple of callers have noticed. But as long as we have this mentality of a permanent warfare state, we're stuck. We're not going to be able to go anywhere. So in the end, I believe it's a public relations problem, really, than a legal problem or a one that will be solved legislatively.
Professor Polito, you want to add something to that?
Just real briefly, constitutional scholar Lewis Fisher at the Library of Congress has done a lot of research in the area of separation of powers between Congress and the executive. And one of the analyses that he did that really struck me was he talked about extraordinary powers that President Lincoln used during the Civil War. And he said that the difference is that when Lincoln exercised these powers, he knew he was going beyond what the Constitution allowed him, and so he sought either approval or rejection from Congress after the fact. And that might seem like a legalistic distinction to some people, but to me it says he was recognizing I'm exceeding the power I was allotted, and rather than doing permanent damage to separation of powers and balance of powers, I'm going to go back to Congress and see whether they will ratify what I did or not. So, I mean, some of the theoretical discussion, I think, has gone way in the other direction, where we just sort of leave the president alone to do what he wants and sort of trust him to do something in which he is expert, rather than looking to the other branches to balance it out. So I found that insight very useful in thinking about how to understand a system where power is divided among branches, but that the legislative is supreme.
Yeah. There we must leave it. If you people who are listening want to read more on the subject, you can look at the book we've mentioned, Presidential Secrecy and the Law, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. By our guests, Robert Polito. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Seton Hall University. Professor Polito, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And William Weaver, Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Texas, El Paso. Professor Weaver, thank you.
Thank you.